Good evening, everyone. Hello and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor of the Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on yoga. Today is the sixth episode in our series of talks focusing on research and practice of yoga for addressing health and wellness. We have had some very interesting discussions on yoga as therapy on this Cure Panel platform. We had Dr. Satbir Khalsa of Harvard University discuss research being done in his lab using yoga as a therapy for different conditions and evaluating the benefits and clinical research studies. David Emerson from the Justice Resource Institute talking about his experience of using yoga to treat patients with trauma. Dr. Larry Payne of Samatha Yoga talk about yoga for people in their 50s and beyond. Dr. Carol Horton and a panel of myeloma patients discussed how practicing yoga helped them through their cancer diagnosis and treatments. In our previous episode, Dr. Richard Miller of IRIS was with us and helped us understand Yoga Nidra, the IRIS program, and its benefits. Today, Dr. Richard Miller of IRIS is back with us, and we are discussing non-dual approach to meditation and its benefits on health. Joining him is our panel of four experienced and distinguished yoga teachers. In January, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a study that said in some cases, mindfulness meditation could be as effective as taking antidepressant medication. Usually our mind goes into default mode, thinks about anything other than the present moment, usually leaning forward into the future about what could happen, worrying, planning, or ruminating about something in the past that's already happened. Meditation brings you into the present moment and sends what's actually happening right now. Dr. Miller is here with us to talk and share his views on meditation from a non-dual perspective. With that, I will hand over to our co-host and resident yoga practitioner, Sharib Khan. Sharib, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya, for the introduction to the show. Dr. Miller, I'm really glad to be back with you on the show. It's such an interesting topic. I'm really looking forward to having a great discussion.
Yes, it's a wonderful honor to be with you and Priya. Thank you very much for inviting me back.
Yeah, and thank you for taking the time out. So I have I wanted to just quickly introduce you to the audience and then get into this really exciting topic. So folks, Dr. Miller is a PhD in clinical psychology. He's an author, researcher, and yogic scholar. He's the founding president of the Integrative Restoration Institute, co-founder of the International Association of Yoga Therapists, and founding editor of the professional journal of the association. He worked with the Walter Reed Medical Center and the United States Department of Defense studying the effect of IRED, which is a program that uses yoga nidra techniques. The IRIS protocol was and is continuing to be used with soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and who have suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. Based on this work, Eric Schumacher, Surgeon General of the United States Army, endorsed yoga nidra as a complementary alternative medicine for chronic pain in 2010, which I believe is a significant achievement in this area and a great step forward for alternative and complementary medicine programs. IRIS is currently supporting active duty veterans and families and service members in over 30 VA or military settings across the United States. Dr. Miller and his organization have established IRIS programs at various military sites, homeless shelters, prisons, hospitals, universities, chemical dependency centers, mental health centers, multiple sclerosis and cancer outpatient clinics, and sites for preschool children, as well as yoga and meditation studios. So with that, I will, once again, Dr. Miller, really, really pleasure to have you on the show. And I'll get straight away into the topic of discussion. So can you enlighten us on what is non-duality and the non-dual consciousness? And we'll start from there.
Well, I think of non-duality as our ability to experience the underlying essence out of which, I might say, ourselves and the entire universe emerges, because we're not separate ultimately from that ground that we all come from. We can learn or experience it for ourselves. And non-dual consciousness is really our underlying state that we all know of as being, or an essence of awareness, but it's something that we don't usually turn into because we're in mostly relating to the objects around us, whether they're trees, other people, our thoughts, our emotions. We're mostly externally oriented, but non-dual meditation asks us to turn back in and awaken or experience this nonverbal essence that forms the underlying essential nature of who we are. So it has a sense of, when we're established in it, of being interconnected with all of life. So when we look at a tree, we look at another person, we see the borders and the boundaries, because that's what our eyes and our senses and our mind, when they're working together, do. They create a sense of border, boundary, and separation. And yet, through meditation, through the practices, we're able to perceive something that isn't separate, that connects us all and connects us to that underlying essence of being.
Mm-hmm. So how is this concept, is this the same as the concept of interconnectedness, or looking at nature and human being as one, or is it a little bit of difference in these two concepts?
It's similar and slightly different, in the sense that when our mind conceptualizes things as one, there's a tendency for the mind to visualize it, and we tend to have ourselves as separate from what we're visualizing. Interconnectedness also has that same flavor of two things that are connected. The underlying essence of non-dual understanding is it goes beyond the intellectual sense of one or interconnected, where we're really feeling at a very nonverbal, very deep existential way the underlying essence of everything, and we know ourselves as not separate from that. In the Indian perspective, the word Advaita, which means non-dual, but actually it means not two. When we use the word not two, our mind really can't conceptualize that, whereas with we say one, everything is one, or everything is interconnected, there's a tendency for us to still have our sense of self as an experiencer who's separate from what we're experiencing, whereas in the non-dual understanding, we really do feel this underlying essence that's not separate, but beyond the concept, we would say, of one.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Actually, I was reading a book on consciousness and how it's now being measured in the lab, and they were talking about how the stereoscope, where one eye can see one object and the other, but cannot see the object that's being shown to the other eye. But in the brain, even though you're getting signals from both the eyes, you don't see a fused image. You're constantly alternating between the two objects being seen. So I find it fascinating that our brain is constantly in the flux of seeing itself and also being connected, seeing itself and also being connected. And, you know, it's interesting to hear how non-duality then gets processed in the brain.
You bring up an interesting research point, because in order to see the world, our eyes have to keep moving. In order to conceptualize ourselves as a separate individual, the mind has to keep moving. As the mind comes to rest and comes to a stop, our sense of self, which is actually discontinuous, it comes and goes, begins to go, and we'll begin to feel our underlying essence, which we call non-dual. For many people, as they begin to feel that underlying essence and the melting away of their sense of separation, it's stepping them outside their normal view of reality and sometimes can be a little unsettling. But as we rest in it and we learn how to feel relaxed in that sense of non-dual, we really do have an insight and a very deep awakening to our real nature.
Yeah. Okay. So let me move to the next. How is yoga nidra a practice of non-duality, or non-dual meditation? Does it follow the same procedure of feeling and, you know, relaxing your body step by step as, you know, you talk about in yoga nidra? Can you explain how yoga nidra and non-duality go together?
Sure. If we think of the word yoga nidra, yoga is the underlying concept that represents our non-dual nature, our ability to feel our underlying interconnectedness with everything. Nidra, while it means a state of sleep, it actually means a changing state of consciousness. So yoga nidra is a practice whereby we're able to experience our sense of non-separation, no matter the state of mind that we may, or the state of consciousness, or the state of our body that we're experiencing. So in that sense, our body could be experiencing pain, discomfort. Our mind could be unsettled by a particular thought or emotion, but yet we're still perceiving an underlying sense of interconnectedness and non-dual. Yoga nidra is a series of practices that help us embrace that understanding, that helps quiet the mind and see this non-changing essence of being that underlies the changing movements of the mind, the body, and emotions. And you reflected on one of the aspects of yoga nidra, is learning how to deeply relax the body, relax emotions, relax the thinking mind, so we can come to a very deep sense of peace or a very underlying sense of stillness that awakens this sense of non-dual. And then yoga nidra helps us bring it back into our daily life, our relationships, so it becomes an integrated life where we're living this sense of non-dual even as we go about our relationships and daily life of object to object.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask a couple of questions, and then get on to the panelists. And or maybe we'll get to these questions later. Let me get one of our panelists on air. We'll start with Dr. Carol Horton. She's Carol Horton is a PhD and is the author of Yoga PhD, Integrating the Life of the Mind and the Wisdom of the Body, and co-editor of the 21st Century Yoga, Culture, Politics, and Practice. She holds a doctorate in political science from the University of Chicago, served on the faculty at McMaster College, and has extensive experience as a research consultant specializing in issues affecting low-income children and families. Certified forest yoga teacher, Carol teaches yoga to women in the Cook County Jail, with Yoga for Recovery, and at Chaturanga Holistic Fitness in Chicago. She is a co-founder of the Socially Engaged Yoga Network, a new organization dedicated to supporting yoga teachers, community organizations, and other stakeholders committed to sharing the benefits of yoga with underserved communities. So with that, I'll bring Carol on air and let her discuss the topic with you, Dr. Moore.
Thank you.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Hi, Carol. Yes.
Hi. Thanks so much. It's such an honor to be on this panel with you, Dr. Miller. So I have a very pragmatic question. As I listen to you speak about non-duality, and I know you're offering your IRES program in public institutions like VA hospitals, have you encountered any issues in terms of perceived clashes between your articulation of a non-dual reality and either the institutional wariness of any sort of religious teachings or sensitivities among students about ideas that might be seen to conflict with their religious beliefs. So I'm thinking, for example, of what happened in Encinitas. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am,
that
yes.
Case. Yeah. And some very conservative Christian parents were concerned about the teaching of yoga in the schools because they felt that the underlying philosophy simply wasn't in accord with their religious beliefs. So is this something that you're open about in those institutions? Is it acceptable and easy to get it in there, or is it something you need to adapt depending on the institution and or the students who happen to be in the program with you?
Well, it's a great question, and I know you're bringing the work into jail systems as well and working with underserved populations as well. To me, what I've worked with is how to make any delivery of the teachings that I do very secular in nature, where when I'm coming in, I'm offering actually a series of tools where the people I'm working with use them for their own self-exploration. There's no sense of coming in with a prescribed agenda or some philosophy that we're trying to impose or different concepts. We're actually asking people, for instance, to relax deeply, taking through a general relaxation that doesn't conflict with anybody's values. And then we're asking them, so when you're this deeply relaxed, what's most drawing your attention in your body? Is there a particular emotion or a thought that's rising for you, and can you describe it? So we're actually helping them move into their own experience and become familiar with it. We're also asking them what I call interviewing questions, where we'll say, do you all know, for instance, what it's like just to be on a summer's day when you're just relaxing between two events and you're just being? And everybody says yes. It doesn't depend on meditation experience. I've worked in homeless shelters, VA centers, all the vets, they all say, yeah, we know what it's like to be. And so I'll ask them then, what's your experience when you're being? For instance, when you're just being, what time is it is? And they'll all say, well, it feels like there's no time. It's timeless. And I'll say, does being need anything? And they all say, well, no, being's just fine the way it is. And do you need to know anything special to be? And they'll say, no, you don't need a teacher. We all know what it is like to be. So as they experience that sense of being, and then I ask, what's it like for you when you're just being? They'll say things like, well, I feel very present. I feel relaxed and at ease. I feel a sense, as one vet said the other day, I feel at home when I'm just being. And then I can use their words back to them. So they've given me basically the words that then I use in helping them reveal deeper aspects of themselves. So there's no sense of imposing. I have gone into very conservative Christian churches. I've gone into homeless shelters, VA centers, jails. And I find because I'm not imposing upon them and I'm really helping them discover themselves, they don't feel a sense of this being something that is adverse or against their teachings. And the seal of housekeeping I'd say I get all the time is this feels like something that's helping me to know myself and my own religion or spiritual values even more than I did before. So I love it if we as teachers, when we've taught a class and everybody's filing out of the room, if they could speak to us silently and say, thank you very much for teaching me today. It felt like you made this class just for me. I think then I've really done a service. So when I go in, I don't use non-secular language. Like I don't necessarily use the word yoga or yoga nidra. I don't use Sanskrit terms. I just come in as a human being relating to another human being, offering them some what I think of as exquisite tools to help them get to know themselves.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Should I ask another question, or do you want to move on to another panelist?
No, you can go ahead, Tao.
Okay. So I had another question, which is really a yoga practitioner type question. I'm curious how you think about the relationship between yoga nidra, sitting meditation, and yoga asana practice. I think there's a widespread belief among more serious yoga practitioners that asana is the least serious practice or has the least depth. Seated meditation is the most advanced practice, and yoga nidra maybe, you know, is in between there. And I wonder if you think that that way of thinking about things is really a useful hierarchy today when we're bringing such a wide range of yoga-related or yoga meditation-type practices to a very wide range of people for a very wide range of reasons.
Yeah,
so I wonder if you, how you think about
I don't
the
see
relative
these
utility
as,
of these
Yeah, I don't
practices.
See these actually as separate practices because in each, when we're practicing movements, say hatha yoga or tai chi or any movement, I think of them as ways that we're learning to sense our body and enter into a very deep, engaged dialogue or relationship with our body. As we are when we sit to meditate, we have to have a familiarity with our body and our emotions as when we're doing yoga nidra. So I'm really seeing them as one underlying essence which we can nourish in each of these practices that each offers, in a way, a different perspective, but we're actually trying to get people or helping them experience themselves and their underlying essence of being or very deep sense of peace. That's at a kind of an ideal level, at a pragmatic or practical level. I understand that many people, like myself, I entered in through the realm of hatha yoga, which introduced me to my body, my mind, my senses. Then the yoga nidra practice deepened that, and then sitting meditation allows me to drop away any kind of external circumstance, and I can really dive deeply into myself. So if I were to place them in a, I think they are along a continuum, one supporting the other, and the underlying essence of being that each one is trying to get at is present in each practice. So when I teach hatha yoga, I actually am teaching meditation yoga nidra. When I'm teaching yoga nidra, I'm teaching body sensing and meditation. And when I'm teaching meditation, I'm teaching yoga nidra and body sensing. So I use all three approaches in every encounter I engage with myself or another. I don't keep them as separate practices.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know
you.
If that's helpful to your
oh,
answer,
yeah.
but...
Yeah, no, that is... I think that's very helpful.
Yeah, and I also think there's a way in which we can, say, denigrate one practice as opposed to the other. I think for me it's more how do we find the richness in each practice and then employ that when it's helpful and let it go when it's no longer necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Carol. I'll bring on our next panelist, Jennifer. Jennifer grew up in Sunnyvale, California, and she has a master's degree in urban and environmental policy from Tufts University. And before that, she went to UC Santa Cruz for environmental studies as well. And she has spent 2 years as an environmental education volunteer with the U.S. Peace Corps in Dominican Republic, and she has taught third grade students summer science and language arts camps, and she is currently working on a memoir titled Never Give Up, and that talks about Buddhism, family, and dealing with schizophrenia. She's been practicing Nisharan Dashanin Buddhism with the Soka Gakkai International for the past 25 years, and she draws on these teachings for encouragement, strength, and inspiration. So, Jennifer, you are on air, and please go ahead with your questions.
Okay. Thank you for having me. Happy to participate in the call this afternoon. I guess I have one question. I was interested in how with the iris meditation, I found this information. I was wondering what is the process or what is meant by the neutralization of stress, negative feelings, emotions, beliefs, images, memories. How is that actually neutralized, I guess, through meditation? Because I know that the negativity, the negative feelings and emotion can go away, but, you know, they will come back, I think, from time to time. And so it's not really something that goes away permanently. So I was wondering what that means or how that works.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. It's a good question. I don't think it's so much as neutralizing. The core principle, I think, in daily life, meditation, and these practices is learning how to listen and how to welcome what's present. So as you say, an emotion rightly comes and goes. Thoughts come and go. Body sensations come and go. We're learning how, as they're coming, to welcome them, listen to them. I think of as messengers. What information do they have to tell us? Responding to those messages and through those responses and engaging in life, in a way the emotions serve their purpose and move on. They may come back later with new messages. So we're not trying to get rid of emotions, thoughts, body sensations. That's an impossible task. We're not, in a way, trying to neutralize them. We're more learning how to be so comfortable with our body, our mind, our senses, that as each is coming, there's no aversion. We're not trying to keep them away. And as they're leaving, we're not trying to hold on to them. So there's neither attachment or aversion. Or we might say there's neither also a feigned neutrality to them. We're really trying to learn how to be responsive as human beings through meditation to our emotions. And my feeling is meditation in its first movement really helps us become a fully functional, alive human being where we're really responsive to our emotions, our body sensations, and our thoughts. We're engaging them all day long. And so when we go to bed, hopefully at night, there's nothing left over, no residues. It's because we really met them during the day, responded, and moved on. Then what I find is the mind becomes more at rest. Emotions don't come with the intensity that they would have might have before when we were resisting or refusing them. So we find a deeper peace or a deeper stillness that some people may phrase as a neutrality, but I think of it as a deep aliveness, this deep resonant dynamic stillness that we come to that points to our deeper nature, our non-dual nature of connectedness with all of life. So then we feel this deep sense of stillness, of peace, as we go through life, and then I think of ourselves as a fully functioning human being. We're both functioning on all cylinders with our emotions, our thoughts. We're engaged with other people. We're responding to the world, and we're living in a deep peace, a deep sense of stillness that carries us through all of the different experiences we're going to have in life. So I'm aware that one of the practices we have in Yoga Nidra, which is contemplating opposites, when there's a feeling of sadness or, say, anger, we can contemplate its opposite as, say, the opposite of sadness might be happiness or peace. The opposite of anger might be peace or love or joy. By contemplating opposites at the same time, it helps us in an interesting way become more comfortable with the original emotion. As we contemplate the opposite of fear, which might be peace, it helps us come back to the fear in a new way and become more comfortable with it. Then we ask people to hold both opposites simultaneously. What they often find is not a neutralization, but a resolution that leads to a deeper insight and a deeper understanding, that as they hold that understanding, It gives them a better sense of how to move through life. As an example, one woman I worked with had a very deep feeling that something was wrong with her. She was unlovable. She contemplated the opposite as I'm lovable. And as she lived with both feelings and contemplated both opposites of I'm unlovable and I'm lovable, she came to a new resolution, realizing there was an underlying tone with her of I'm love itself, which enabled her then to tolerate being unloved. And because she came from an abusive family background where abuse was often coupled with love, she found she could tolerate love in a whole new way and didn't link it to abuse. And so by contemplating opposites, I'm unlovable and I'm lovable, she came to a new resolution within herself that enabled her to go back into her life in a whole new way that was unexpected for her. So I wouldn't say neutralize. I would say it enlivens us to really meet ourselves in a very deep way.
Wow.
This is really exciting and interesting stuff, Dr. Milan. Jennifer, I'll want to get some more details from Dr. Miller here. So you use the word resolve. To my understanding and feeling on how the mind works is that usually at a time when you're not engaging it with something active, a lot of the unresolved issues start to take up the attention of the mind. So as you're practicing this, are you saying that through this practice we are able to create space? So when you say response, how is the response through thinking or is it through specific action? How does the process work?
And well, you're raising a couple of very vital points, I think. When we do these practices, whether it's Hatha Yoga, Yoga Nidra, meditation, it does open the door to the unconscious and all our unresolved issues, emotions, and thoughts. And slowly, as we resolve the uppermost ones, it makes room for the lower ones to begin to emerge into consciousness. I often think of these little Pez candy dispensers where you take one Pez out and the next one comes up. It's the same thing with our emotions. And so a lot of the early work in meditation and these practices is to become comfortable and learning how to work with the emerging emotions or repressed material so that we have tools to meet it in a way that both helps us meet it and resolve it and take actions into the world that we might have otherwise before been refusing to take. As we resolve more and more of these underlying emotions, when the mind comes to a rest, there's no new material that's emerging, and we spend more and more time at rest or at peace or in this deep stillness. And initially, meditation for most people is they're trying to find this peace, they're trying to get this deep stillness into their life. Later on, we come to the realization that peace and stillness have always been here waiting for us. We were just distracted or overwhelmed by the emotions that were lying on top of it. Later on, that deep stillness impregnates our entire life. So eventually, even when repressed or long forgotten emotions emerge, it doesn't displace that deep sense of peace or stillness. So we feel it in the midst then of our activities in life. At first we're trying to find it. Later on it's found us, and it's always, in a manner of speaking, with us, no matter where we are, what we're engaged in doing.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about response, are you saying that any feeling or emotion that comes, we respond to it through thought or through actual action?
I think of them as actual actions. In other words, a thought or an emotion, say an emotion arises. Let's take anger as an emotion because most people are familiar with it. Mm-hmm. When we feel angry, it's usually because we have an expectation that isn't coming forward. In other words, we're expecting something to happen and life gives us something else instead and we get irritated. The anger, if we really learn to welcome it, helps us understand the expectation we were having, see that life is offering us a different alternative, and when we engage actively that alternative, the anger has served its purpose, the expectation melts away, and we're back into life. For instance, a couple of years ago, I was in Chicago trying to get a plane, and I came to the doorway, and they slammed the door in front of me, and the stewardess was on the other side, and I said, "Open the door, I can get on the plane." She said, "No, once we close the door, that's it." And I could feel a piece of irritation because life was giving me something other than what I wanted. But I quickly turned to the person who was manning the gate next to me and said, "Is there another plane?" And she said, "Just a couple of gates down." I engaged that action, went and actually got on a plane. But as I was leaving, another person showed up who had also been shut out of that plane, and they started going into a tantrum and engaging their anger rather than using the anger to see the expectation, to see what action do I need to take. So when I'm working with people in meditation or privately, I'm always asking them when they have an emotion or a thought or a body sensation, what's the action that this is calling you to take into your life? And sometimes that action will be just to stop and be still. Other times it may be to call someone to write something, a letter, or to take a new job, for instance. So to me, it's action, and it's not just in thought. It's actually in our body that we feel it as a whole bodily response.
Okay. Jennifer, if you have anything else, please go ahead. Sorry, I came in between.
No problem. Yeah. I was just going to actually comment that it seems there is something very similar concept in Buddhism that I'm familiar with. It's called the oneness of self and environment, and it's sort of the same idea as non-duality. It's translated from the Japanese. There's a word that means two but not two, so which is referring to the self, the person, and the person's everything in the person's environment. And it's the idea that not quite of opposites, but like if you think of like a coin, how a coin is one coin in and of itself, but it has the head side and it has the tail side.
Right,
so
and to follow that, there's, say, the emotion and the response we have. They're not separate. They're not two. They're actually one. And I often tell people within us, we all have the perfect response to each moment if we could just clear out the obstructions, the emotions or the thoughts that get in our way, we'd see the perfect response, and by taking it, there'd be a sense of harmony. So I agree with you. Life looks like two sides of a coin, but it's one coin. There's looks like myself and life happening that's separate from me, but my response is actually not separate. It's life, me, and the response. They're all together as one unit, not separate.
Right. I think it's that there's a part of our lives or a dimension, a part of our lives that at the most fundamental level, we are not separate from our environment or everything else around us. It's just at a very fundamental level that we really aren't aware of unless, you know, maybe we're taught or we're trained or we learn how to become aware of it. So there is, at a very deep level, that's the level that there is the oneness that's there. It's just
At a very fundamental neurological level, developmentally, our body, our mind, our senses, their job is to create a sense of separation, separate objects, environment versus ourself. And we may then lose touch with that deep sense of not being separate from our environment. Meditation and these wonderful practices, by their nature, are designed to help us reawaken to that underlying essence where we're not separate from our environment. And my sense is the only way that we can destroy the environment, that we can go to war, is because we enculture a sense of separation. As that sense of separation dissolves and we are deeply moved by feeling our not separateness from nature and our environment, there's no way we could be destructive or go to war. It no longer makes sense. So these are core practices that really instill a deep sense of our underlying realization that everything around us, trees, rocks, all the people, they in a way are ourself in another form, and it creates deep relationship.
Well, thank you, Dr. Milan. Thank you, Jennifer. And I'm going to actually ask you a question and then bring our last panelist. And I wanted to frame all of this discussion and have you talk a little bit about how this actually impacts our health. Like, what are some of the physiological or neurochemical changes that we have shown that happened because of this? And can you talk a little bit about that? And then I'll bring on our last panelist, Morgan.
Well, I think you're getting at the neuroscience. We see, for instance, when people experience depression long-term or anxiety or long-term stress or post-traumatic stress, there are actually organic changes in the brain. The amygdala structures, the limbic system, tends to increase in size. People become more dominant in destructive emotions, and their hippocampal structures tend to shrink and grow smaller, where they lose a sense of connectedness and responsibility and are unable often to see the consequences of their actions. As they meditate, just the reverse happens. They feel less hijacked by their emotions. Their amygdala, limbic system comes back to normal size. Their hippocampal areas grow in size. Their neocortex in the front of the brain thickens. Interestingly, when we meditate, it actually takes us out of the way we normally hold time and space. And if we look at a person in MRI when they're in deep meditation, we see parts of their brain go offline and new parts go online, and it actually disrupts their sense of separation, time, space, and takes them into this dimension of timelessness where they feel a sense of non-separation. And we see changes in cortisol levels decreasing, the immune system gets turned on. To me, one of the best things somebody could practice for immunological diseases, fibromyalgia, cancer, multiple sclerosis, is meditation, yoga nidra. So the research we've been doing with people who are undergoing treatment for cancer or who have long-term multiple sclerosis, we find deep help in helping them cope with their treatments, as well as sometimes we find their immune system turning on and enhancing their treatment. In the VA, we often see the vets telling us that they need less medication or they've gone off their medication. And so there are lots of physiological changes we see just in helping a person relax, even more so when they go into prolonged meditation over many periods. I was just reading a research article by Richie Davidson, who does a lot of work out of Wisconsin with MRIs, and he was showing that in one session of meditation, we can affect quite profound changes, and even more so with each session that's added. And we can get irreversible positive changes, for instance, in six sessions that can be life-changing. And I've often seen people with chronic pain in one session or over multiple sessions, one, either their pain disappears or it ameliorates and lessens, or at least they've found tools with which they can work with it. So there's some really profound direct and immediate consequences of doing, say, yoga nidra or meditation in general on chronic pain, depression, anxiety. It's a very incredible intervention if it's given in the right way, because we always adapt it to the individual. We're, even when we're working in groups, we're always looking at the individual within the group, so everybody is in a way getting a meditation that's tailored for them and what they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much on that. Actually, we have both Catherine and Morgan to go, so I'm going to quickly get them on air. We're running a little out of time. So our next panelist is Morgan Dix, who for the last 19 years has been an intensive student of meditation and yoga. He's also an entrepreneur who combines his passion for spiritual practice and writing to help educate others about the benefits of these practices. He's the co-founder of the media platform About Meditation, and you can visit it at aboutmeditation.com, and I'll let him ask his questions. Morgan, you're on the air.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, Morgan. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Miller, and it's a pleasure to be on the air and an honor to be part of the panel. Thank you so much. And I find your work very inspiring, and I wanted to ask a question. Your work with IRIS integrates your experience with a several thousand year old tradition, and your expertise as a psychologist. And as I understand it, the inquiry exploring this juncture of Eastern Dharma and yoga and Western psychology that's really been developing since, you could say, on one hand, the 60s or the 70s when you first got interested in this whole area. And then if you count, you could say when Vivekananda came to the West almost 100 years ago and his impact on people like William James, you could say, really, there's been an intermixture here that's been going on for over a century, and an arc of development that personally I find intriguing and promising. And being newly exposed to your work, obviously you're a pioneer in this area, and it's inspiring to learn about your work. I spent many years in a Neo-Advaita tradition.
Yes, I saw that.
Right. In our tradition, really, one's individuality in some respects was suppressed and renounced for the sake of keeping our minds fixed on God or consciousness. And, of course, that has its benefits, and I learned a lot from that approach. And yet, in retrospect, with some distance, I question the ultimate efficacy of that approach for our time, for postmodern human beings. And I also saw some outcomes to that approach that weren't so positive, in particular a kind of reductionism, which reduced people to a limited range of acceptable behaviors, responses, and self-expression. So in that light, I was particularly moved when you spoke, and in certain ways you've been speaking to this through the whole panel today, but when I listened to your last panel, about how the IRIS protocol really, it has the flexibility to respond to the unique needs of each individual. And in fact, I got the impression, correct me if I'm wrong, that it really has to take the different needs of each individual into consideration and their own unique situation to really
correct.
Have the greatest impact. So
correct.
I would love, in the context of what we're speaking about today, exposing people to non-dual consciousness, I wondered if you could speak really to that element of the tailored approach, why you think that really specific response to an individual and their unique needs is so important, and what that looks like in practice. I mean, that's really my first question. And then if I may just quickly add a second one, just how you see, I mean, this kind of incredible evolutionary arc between the Eastern traditions and Western psychology, what you're seeing, what you're excited about. Obviously, your work is an expression of that evolution in significant and promising ways.
Well, let me see if I can speak directly and succinctly as possible. We have to take the understanding that at one level, there are no separate individuals. There's just nature giving rise to what looks like separate individuals. So in the words of the Dalai Lama, it's not as if the self ever existed. We're realizing that the self is actually an invention of the mind. It doesn't actually exist except as a concept. Mm-hmm. So when we're working with the individual, we realize that each is a unique expression of nature. Mm. And my desire is always in the unique expression of each individual, trying to really bring out and unfold their unique flowering. As we might look at separate roses, they're all roses, but each has a distinct scent and a unique expression. So when I think of meditation or yoga nidra specifically, it has to be tailored to the individual as a unique expression of life. And each individual has their specific, I would say, purpose. And so we're trying to expose what that purpose is. So we're not trying to contain them into imposed actions that we think they should be doing. We're trying to find out what are the actions and the way of living life that when you live them, you really feel yourself, one, as a unique expression, but as a flowering of that underlying unity that we all come out of. So I keep in mind that there looks like they're individuals, but in fact it's just life expressing itself. So it has to be tailored to the individual. And, you know, it dovetails with this evolutionary arc that I do see happening. And recently I understood that even Thomas Jefferson and others, when they went to Europe back in the 1700s and before, they were being exposed to these ideas that had impregnated Europe that had come from the East. So there's a long arc here that's really coming to fruition now.
Yeah.
And my sense is if we think of all of humanity on a bell curve, there are some we might call outliers who are really deeply experiencing this sense of non-dual reality and the underlying, I might say, oneness or not separation of all of life. Most of humanity isn't doing that, but my sense is that bell curve is slowly moving, so what's going to happen in 10,000 years, another 20,000 years? My sense is our brain is developing in such a way that more people will naturally be living in that non-dual state, less people. And, you know, we know that the ego, which creates a sense of separation, is new on the genetic scene. It didn't exist a couple of million years ago or a million years ago. It's a new invention of the neocortex. So I think of we're all in that evolutionary movement. Where is the ego as a structure going to be, say, in 20,000 years? It may come as a unique expression that's helping us have a sense of separation or individuality, but at the same time realizing that we're not. We're actually all one part of nature expressing itself. So. I always keep that in mind. Who is this person in front of me? They're a flower of life. How do they need to flower? I don't know how they should. I know that they do. If we can really help them explore themselves, that flowering comes out very beautifully.
Thank you so much.
So I'll bring our last panelist, Catherine. Thank you so much, Morgan, and I forgot to add that Morgan actually has been with the Enlightened Next Foundation and organization for a long time, and thank you for that interesting question. Catherine is our last panelist, and she was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in 1996. Since then, she has used Tai Chi and mindful meditation to support her immune system and deal with side effects related to the treatment. She's also followed personal interest to become a neuroscientist specializing in investigating brain mechanism underlying the effects of Tai Chi and mindfulness on aging, pain, and other clinical situations. She's an assistant professor at Brown University School of Medicine and director of translational neuroscience at Brown University. Thank you so much, Catherine, for taking your time, and please, you're on air. Feel free to ask the questions from Dr. Miller.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate and I'm happy to be learning about this, the wonderful work that you've been doing. And I just have actually just one question that I think is actually, it's a pretty practical question.
Mm-hmm.
I study the effects of mindfulness on the brain and on illness. And I this weekend I presented at the international meeting about the effects of doing different doing a breath focus in different body locations. And we presented a neural model on that, and which is interesting, but isn't that relevant. But there were numerous teachers at our session who talked about some of their, these are mindfulness teachers, who talked about some of their students who start out very avoidant of the body. And the examples they mentioned were perhaps obesity or a history of trauma.
Yes.
And so for some people, especially people with a history of trauma, the experience of simply sitting and focusing can be, as I'm sure you probably know better than I, can be quite flooding.
Correct.
Emotionally. And that these teachers talked about their sort of techniques for sensing when this is happening and managing this, and also for being able to say there are people who, for whom sitting mindfulness practice is probably is not appropriate for them at this moment in time, given where they are in their process. And so I wanted to find out about how you discern, you know, to make modifications or to even suggest to someone that, you know, maybe a brisk walking practice or something might be better for them, and how do you sort of sort that out practically as a teacher?
It's a good practical question, and I think this is why, again, it's so important, even when I'm working in a group, say there are 12 people in the room, I'm trying to relate to 12 individuals and what does each need. And I try to have individual conversations and also meet with people individually so I can help them explore, because as you say rightly, sitting meditation for many people just doesn't work. It's antithetical and it causes more agitation. For them, it might be a lying down meditation or, as you say, some engaged walking or body movement practice. A lot of people who've had physical or sexual abuse, by beginning to sense their body, it reawakens a lot of emotion and it can flood, as you say, their system. So I'm always looking at how can we create continuums of experience from very benign and gentle to help them begin to welcome their body, learn how to relate to it in a way that they can see it as their friend, not their enemy, and slowly engage in deeper and deeper practices of body sensing. So it's really the engaged conversation, I think, is really helpful. Having them to describe, so I'll give them introductory, just brief practices to see how do they take it, how do they handle it, and then build sequentially over a period of time. We've had wonderful success, I think, primarily because we don't have people first sitting in meditation or moving. We just have them lying down and helping them learn to basically relax. We tell them it's okay to fall asleep. So even during meditation, we have people snoring at times. We're helping mm-hmm. them learn that there are many ways of approaching meditation that's unique to them as individuals. So it's hard to generalize because I've got to have the person in front of me, but just that same adage I keep coming back to, we're always working with the individual. I have a whole quiver of tools, I think of it as a tool belt, which tools are appropriate for this person. While I have ones that I tend to take out to try immediately, like body sensing with a person lying down and just sensing their hands, I'm looking for them to describe their experience so then I can begin to tailor the practice specifically to them, where we might not have them doing breathing right away. We might have them doing something else, or there's a particular breathing exercise we might adapt for them right away. But it's that interactional relationship, I think, that really is important in student-teacher relationship, where the student really does feel we're listening to them, we're trying to understand them deeply, we're trying to help them discover the practices that are just right for them, and we understand that this can take time, and we have all the time that they need to meet them. So compassion, caring, empathy, I think are all part of developing a good relationship.
I think this is, I love what you just said about the toolkit and, you know, approaching each person individually and with a compassionate spirit. You know, I'm a part of a contemplative studies initiative at Brown University, and one of my colleagues is actually, Willoughby Britton, has been looking at adverse effects of some meditation programs, and it seems like there are certain programs where there's a spirit of, you know, pushing and breaking through and, you know, doing different things with the breath that can be quite aggressive. And I think your program sounds like, you know, having people understand that there might be this other pathway and that there are these modifications.
Yeah, the bottom line for me is, self-inquiry and welcoming. How can this person really feel like we're welcoming them just the way they are, where they are and how they are, and beginning to help them find who they are through inquiry versus telling them these are the practices you need to do. I got no idea what the practice is for any person when they first come to me, so it's a discovery we're on. But as you said, I have a tool belt, so I can offer different tools. But when they tell me this tool doesn't work, my first response is, great, now we know that doesn't work. You want to try this or what feels right to you? So it's always a collaborative relationship we're building with our students.
Well, I'm very excited about this. And I think, there are certain, right now there are some ongoing projects to interview healers and teachers and learn, so that we can sort of transmit these ideas more generally, especially if people are finding that they're in a yoga or meditation program that's not agreeing with them on a deep level, other ways.
Yeah, and I remember when I first started out, I had limited tools, so I could only offer a few things. I think that wisdom as we grow old and we have lots of tools, it'd be wonderful to put ourselves in these kind of environments where we're passing them on to the next generation so they can get as many tools as quickly as they can so they can help their clients.
Don't have to reinvent the wheel.
No, exactly.
Oh, thank you. That's very helpful. And I'll talk to Willoughby Britton about this, and one of us might be in contact.
Oh, wonderful, because I know Willoughby, so I'd love to be in contact.
Great.
We do have callers in, and some. I just want to wrap it up quickly. We're definitely going above time, and we still have a few questions that were submitted that I would have liked to bring up. But before we end, I want to see if somebody in the audience would like to ask a question. And if so, please press 1 on your keypad, and we'll bring you on air. And if not, I'll try to quickly wrap things up. Dr. Miller, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful discussion. Thank you to all the panelists, Morgan, Carol, Jennifer, and Catherine, for the questions and the discussion. And as we wait for somebody to press 1 on the keypad, I will try to ask a couple of the questions we received from via email. So, can you talk, somebody wants to specifically know how non-duality can be used in psychotherapy, and about any, and it seems like you talked about this in a conference in San Francisco a few days back. So can you talk a little bit about that, Dr. Miller?
I can, and the conference was on the use of non-duality in psychotherapy, and I helped found the organization years ago, and it's a wonderful organization. We meet every year. non-duality principles are, to me, very useful in psychotherapy because we don't see the client as someone separate from us. We're forming an empathic bridge with them as we're working with them. And in a way, we're listening to when, as they're learning to welcome themselves, as I was saying, learn these different tools, how to meet and greet and really be with their emotions, their thoughts, there's a natural stillness that begins to come that many therapists who aren't oriented will miss it and not understand what it is. When I'm working with someone one-to-one and I can feel that presence coming into the room, I'll often ask them to just take a moment and comment if there's anything else that they're experiencing right now they might not have noticed. And at times they may say, well, now that you say it, there feels like there's this wonderful kind of silence or stillness here. And then I'll say, so can you take time and really sense that and invite it into your body and into your room? When we're oriented with these meditational perspectives, we can weave in experiences that a client is often having that a non-oriented therapist might otherwise miss. And we do know that when clients are interviewed, 75 to 80% of them say that spirituality is a part of what they're bringing to the psychotherapy hour. And if psychotherapists aren't trained or oriented in this perspective, then they can be doing their clients a disservice.
Right. Well, thank you so much for that. I think we've really gone above time, so I will end the panel today with that final question. Thank you once again, Dr. Miller. Thank you all the panelists, Morgan, Carol, Jennifer, Catherine. And we will have the recording of the show available for you all to listen to and others as well. And we look forward to the next panel, and we'll keep everybody informed. Dr. Miller, thank you so much. And I'm really hoping to come down to San Francisco and get a chance to actually enroll in your IRES program training workshop or something very soon.
Well, I look forward to seeing you. I thank you, Shareev, and I thank you, Priya, for the show. It's a wonderful show. Thank you for bringing me on and all of our guests and who are on asking questions. So deeply, Carol and Jennifer and Morgan and Catherine, thank you for being part of the show.
Okay, folks. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.